Dunkin' Cold Coffee can be brewed at home in your Keurig coffee maker with Dunkin' Cold K-Cup Pods. Just brew it hot over ice and enjoy flavor that's crafted to serve cold. The home with Dunkin' is where you want to be.
My new book, How Minds Change, is out there, printed on paper, available as an ebook, listenable as an audiobook in some places, and soon to be available as an audiobook in all places. How Minds Change is an exploration of the science behind how and why we change our minds, how and why we don't, what that phrase even means. And it explores the resistance of conspiratorial thinking, ideology, political partisanship, cults and pseudo-cults, as well as what it takes to break through that kind of resistance when it comes to changing minds on matters factual, moral, ethical, political, and otherwise. It's a very on-the-ground book. I spent time in person with scientists, activists, people who had left cults and pseudo-cults and other conspiratorial communities and things like that. And by the end, you get real actionable advice on how you can apply all that to repair relationships, improve communication, and change minds about the things you care about, whether that's between you and one person within an institution or part of activism and outreach aimed for an audience of millions. For more info on the book and to enter a contest to win a copy of the book and to watch a roundtable video with experts from the book and so much more, check out the link in the show notes in your podcast player. Okay, let's start the show. Welcome to the You Are Not So Smart podcast, episode 239. Our guest in this episode is the behavioral scientist John Levy, who wrote a book titled You're Invited: The Art and Science of Cultivating Influence. The book details how John had no money, no reputation, or status, but was still able to convince groups of Nobel laureates, Olympians, celebrities, Fortune 500 executives, and even a princess to not only give him advice, but cook him dinner, wash his dishes, sweep his floors, and then thank him for the experience. It's all very positive and benevolent, and it's about creating networks to create change in the world. And at the time of our recording, John had hosted 227 dinners across 10 cities and 10 countries with more than 2,000 people, building a network, a private community that is now known as The Influencers, which has grown into the largest private group of its kind worldwide. In the book, Levy goes through all the science behind what works and what doesn't when it comes to creating a network like this, and how to create something like this in your own life, how to connect with people, reconnect with people, build community. And that's what we talk about in the interview, as well as the loneliness epidemic, competitive dog grooming, the IKEA effect, and all the things he learned about influence, creating and managing his dinner parties, and how to maybe, just maybe, use what he's learned to change the world for the better.
My name is John Levy. I'm a human behavioral scientist, and I spend most of my life convincing people to cook me absolutely terrible meals.
And I really have so much respect for what you figured out here, and we'll get into it in a second. I wanted to first just say, like, how has COVID affected your grand scheme? Because your grand scheme requires people to get together and do stuff in person. So what did you do?
So first of all, I've been eating much better meals because my scheme is all about usually about 12 people who have no idea how to cook preparing a meal together. And so it's usually burritos, and the the comment I make is like, listen, for a lot less money, I could be eating Chipotle and it would taste a lot better. When sheltering at home started, I didn't do what everybody else did, which was a lift and shift, right? Everybody else took their in-person activities and said, oh, we're going to put them online. But that's not really how human beings interact with either technology or media, right? So if I took a radio show and then just like put it on television, it tends not to be that interesting mm-hmm. because the medium allows you to do things that are much more dynamic. What we did was we took the basic principles of everything that we do in person and then figured out how to take those principles and bring them to life in a meaningful way across Zoom or whatever digital platform we were using. And so it became this highly interactive, at times it turned into a full game show where all the attendees were participants and actors and active in the experience, as opposed to like pumping through a third-rate video recording of a music concert that you could see better on YouTube.
This that you're telling me and just your history, your story, which we'll consider all this foreshadowing. We'll get to all of it. But you remind me a great deal, not your humanity, not your personhood, but your obsession reminds me a great deal of, I have two friends in that work in spaces that do this sort of thing. One is Misha Globerman in Toronto, who that's his obsession is how do you get people together in a room and see what happens? And he mm-hmm. has turned that into his profession. And then over COVID, he also came up with these wild ideas over Zoom and other things to make, to do experiments. And then the other person is Alistair Kroll, who runs conferences, but his actual obsession is how do I get people I know to meet each other. And mm-hmm. because he does a lot of conferences, he comes across a lot of people who are working in something that he thinks would synthesize with this person, but they don't know it yet. And he puts people together. So when I started reading about your stuff and watching your TED talk and everything, I was like, wow, there's a couple of these people out there. I don't know how many there are because it takes a very particular kind of person. It takes an incredible amount of effort and you have to, but the results, if you like actually pull it off, are amazing. So that being said, and that's just to ingratiate myself to you. So let me pull all the way back and just for the people who are listening, you're a scientist, you're a behavioral scientist. So tell me a little bit about your academic background. Tell me a little bit about your sciencey science-ness.
So I actually ended up doing research much later in life than most people who get interested into it. I at one of my dinners, I hosted a pretty well-known neuroscientist by the name of Moran Cerf. He's a brilliant guy. He was like the first one who kind of figured out how to project thoughts. And he said, you know, part of my job is to find people who should be doing research in academia and foster that skill in them. And I think you should start doing research. I think I was like 33 at the time. Hmm. And he's like, let's start doing research together and see where it goes. And so I said, okay, if I'm going to be doing this kind of work, let me bring my magic. You know, my magic is around connecting with people, building trust, and giving them a sense of belonging. And so I was able to get companies that would never open up their data, like never, to say, okay, what do you want to do? And so we were able to use a full year of data from the dating app Hinge and did the largest, I think it's the largest study in history on dating. And we looked at 421 million potential matches between people and asked what actually gets people to start dating. And you know how people say opposites attract? Mm-hmm. Total lie. They do not attract almost ever. There are very rare occasions, but across every characteristic, the more similar you are, the more likely you are to date. And that shouldn't surprise us because things that are familiar, we tend to like more. It's called the mirror exposure effect. And so if we had the same haircut, we would feel more comfortable around each other, right? Homogeneous groups are easy. The one exception that we really did find, which I thought was super funny, was I expected introverts to want to date introverts and extroverts to date extroverts. And they probably would, except for one problem. the introverts never start conversations. So you need kind of at least one extrovert. And if both people are extroverts, there's a ton of dating taking place. So the other weird things we found is, like, if you have the same initials, you're more than 11% more likely to date.
Whoa, that's weird.
Isn't it? It's called implicit egotism. It's kind of like that extreme version of the mirror exposure effect. Anything that reminds us of ourselves is more appealing.
Implicit egotism goes on the big list of things that I want to learn more about. I like this a lot. The fact that you went straight to Hinge and that we have information from Hinge, I find that really cool because there's a lot of interesting research has come out of Hinge and Match and OkCupid, like just stuff about how people work. There are some uncomfortable truths that come out of it also that I find really compelling. But yeah. I read a good portion of your book and I was like, this is great. This is because you pepper a lot of psychology in there too, but you also have you have a unique opportunity to speak with so many different people and be plugged into so many different worlds. Mm. You're so intensely networked that you can present a book that has a lot more to offer than just pop psychology. I'm wondering though, and I don't think I've been able to find this anywhere. What were you doing before you started researching that stuff?
So I was at a failed tech startup because that was the cool thing to do in the early 2000s and mid 2000s. And then I was right before I was at Rodale, which owns Men's Health, Women's Health, Runner's World. And the company doesn't really exist anymore. They sold to Hearst. They had a research, a library sciences team. So they had, I think it was 3 or 5 people, I don't even remember at this point, that we could ask any question and they'd pull the research. And then I would use that research to develop strategies for companies. We were part of the in-house agency. And so that's when I really, really started getting into applied behavioral science, because day in, day out, I'd find the latest kind of studies that would have an impact.
That's so cool. Your book, let's talk about how this whole thing gets started, because I love that you, I just love that you pulled off what to me is like a really, like a behavioral bank heist. yes. You really pulled.
This is like the Marvel Universe time heist, but with, like fancier people. Uh-huh.
So you have this book called You're Invited. And I imagine this book is the result of, you know, just the fact that you came up, you did this really amazing thing. And then you sort of back propagate through it all, the science behind it also.
It happened both ways.
Oh, tell me.
So in the sense that I came to some very clear conclusions and I was like, okay, I have to build around these principles. And then as you're running it and I'm doing research and I come across more research, then I augment it because it's a living, breathing thing, right? I've hosted 227 dinners across 10 cities in 3 countries.
Over what time scale is that, 227?
Just over a decade. I'll be honest, I don't really remember the exact date of the first dinner. It was either 2009 or 2010, but it took kind of like a year to develop the concept. So I was running a bunch of dinners that weren't the influencers dinner before then. Mm-hmm. But you could see like the initial elements of it. Like a bunch of friends would come out over Friday night, we'd cook dinner and hang out. And so you're like, okay, I start seeing like the pieces, because everybody thinks that an innovation just happens, right? Like suddenly you have an idea, you build the Iron Man suit. And it's not like that. It's, you know, you take inspiration throughout, you obsess over the ideas, you build parts of things, you try them. And then eventually it evolves and develops and grows and it looks nothing like it did on day one.
What made you even want to do this at all in the first place?
So I was 28, maybe 29. And I was like the stereotypical person, quote, like not living up to their potential. Right? I was like underemployed. I was heavily in debt from school. I, you know, overweight. I would beat myself up every day for not waking up at 6 a.m. to work out. And I wanted some kind of change. And I'd keep reading like personal development books and pop science books. And those things help. It's great. Like it's, you know, that knowledge is super helpful. But I'm not sure if you've noticed this. There's a huge gap between like the advice that Bill Gates will give you and what's actually applicable to your life.
Right? Right.
And the issue is, I would argue, in reproducibility. Right. So what I love about the sciences is that if you have the same problem with the same conditions, and I tell you the protocol, you should be able to recreate it within a certain margin of error. Right. Mm-hmm. So it's reproducible. I could read every book by every billionaire and never reproduce what they did. And that's, I think, one of the fundamental problems, is that the advice that we're taking isn't based on actual research. It's worked for one person at one time under a specific set of conditions.
Mm-hmm. Survivorship bias.
Yep, exactly. That's exactly it. And, you know, otherwise the best bet would be get into Harvard and drop out because you'll become a billionaire mm-hmm. like Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg.
Right.
So the question became, what's kind of more universal? And I was sitting in a seminar and the leader said that the fundamental element that defines the quality of our lives are the people we surround ourselves with and the conversations that we have with them. And I said, huh, maybe I'm taking the wrong approach. Maybe what I should focus on less is having perfect self-control and waking up early every day. Maybe instead of that, I should focus on having friends that really enjoy exercise. So that way it'll be a natural part of my routine. Because then, David, when the two of us are hanging out, you'll say, hey, let's go for a run instead of, oh, let's go for cocktails. And then I have healthier habits by the people I surround myself with. And there's this wonderful study done by Christakis and Fowler. They were looking at the obesity epidemic, and they were curious if it spreads from person to person like a cold, or if it's more like a percentage of the population thing. And what they found was startling, that if you have a friend who's obese, your probability increases by 45%. Your friends who don't know them have a 20% increased chance, and their friends have a 5% increased chance.
This is the Farmington Heart Study, if I'm correct.
I think it took the data from it.
Okay. But, and it's just, it's insane how much data that thing has and how long. We'll pick up right here in the conversation after this commercial break. At work or at home, we all know one person who is really password challenged. I am sure you know someone like this. They put their passwords on sticky notes all around their workplace. They email passwords to people saying, yeah, here's the password to that. They reuse their passwords on every site. And maybe this is you. Maybe you're doing some of these things. I get it. Passwords are a hassle. And the problem with all that is that data breaches affect everyone. Everyone at your company, everyone in your life, your family, data breaches happen and passwords get found and discovered and distributed. So you need something. You need something above and beyond whatever it is you're using now. And that thing that you need is 1Password, the number 1Password, one single term, 1Password. That's the name of this product that I think you should have. I used 1Password way back in the day before other password managers came around. And I'm still using it because it works. It's great. 1Password combines industry-leading security with award-winning design to bring private, secure, and user-friendly password management to everyone across platforms. Companies lose hours every day just from employees forgetting and resetting their passwords. A single data breach can cost millions of dollars, and 1Password is there to prevent these sorts of things. It secures every sign-in to save you time and money. Any device, anytime, across platforms, across devices, 1Password lets you securely switch between iPhone, Android, Mac, PC, and it has all these convenient features like autofill for quick sign-ins. All you have to remember is the one strong account password that protects everything else. Your logins, your credit cards, your notes, your office Wi-Fi password, the Wi-Fi over at your mom and dad's. 1Password generates as many strong, unique passwords as you need and securely stores all of them in an encrypted vault that only you have access to. I particularly love this when I'm moving back and forth between devices and platforms. That's the thing that makes it great. And my father has a problem with all these things. Many times, this person who I love has forgotten his password. He has it written down somewhere. I go and find where he has it written down, and I see everything. I see every password the man has, and I said, look, here's the thing you need to get. They're an advertiser on my show. I have used this for a while. Use this one password. Now I feel very safe when it comes to all the things in his life that could ruin my mom and dad's lives if the passwords were taken and somebody got into his bank account or into his computer or anything. So yes, here it is. Right now, my listeners can get a free 2-week trial at onepassword.com/YANSS. That's the number one password. It's all one term. onepassword.com/YANSS. That's 2 free weeks at onepassword.com/YANSS. One more time, onepassword.com/YANSS.
Hey, Keurig coffee drinkers. Did you know that the bold, smooth taste of Dunkin' cold coffee can be brewed in your Keurig coffee maker and enjoyed at home? Dunkin's cold K-Cup pods were crafted to be brewed hot and enjoyed cold. And of course, they're packed with the Dunkin' flavor you crave. Brew over ice and sip in seconds. Because the home with Dunkin' is where you want to be.
And now we return to our program. The Farmington Heart Study, if I'm correct.
I think it took the data from it.
Okay. But, and it's like, it's insane how much data that thing has and how long it's been recorded and how many things you can pull out of it. And now there's like computer models that turn it into this warping mass of, it looks like a old chemistry stick and ball kind of thing. And you can use this incredible resource to study all sorts of things. And I have had a similar feeling as you have looking into it. Like, I cannot believe I am being influenced by people I don't know, but who do know people I do know, to the point that, like, I think I've seen a list of like 120 things, from smoking to obesity to just about anything that can be habitual is influenced by people.
Marriage
I don't
and
know.
Divorce rates, smoking.
That's
habits,
huge.
Voting
That's huge.
Habits.
Because it cascades through the network. It ripples through the network, but in three dimensions, and maybe more dimensions than that, because there's social dimensions.
I think it's important to point out that there are several factors. One is that if we met at the gym, we're more likely to be healthier. So part of it is homophily, right? Like birds of a feather flock together. Part of it is that there's also a direct like influence, right? So if I kind of like the spread of fax machines, right? Once I had a fax machine and you didn't, and we needed to exchange documents, it became a lot more appealing for you to have a fax machine, and things spread through networks. And now half the listeners are like, what's a fax machine? It's like an email that sounds like you're firing bombs over a phone line.
It's a printer I can call that sits in your house and it prints out what I tell it to. It's very strange. You remember the Back to the Future 2 when they predicted that there would be fax machines in every room of the house? I thought that was great. And
we'd be wearing double ties.
Now that I wish we were doing. Like, I don't know why someone hasn't tried to start the double tie look, because I thought it was pretty neat.
It's really hard to like knot it.
Well, I would assume it would come with this. Like, if we've got self-lacing shoes, we should have double tie shirts.
Knotting ties. So anyway, that kind of points to this idea that not only is it important to curate the people in your life, but there's this kind of non-directly obvious characteristic of those studies, which is that if we want something to spread faster through the network, we should introduce people to each other. So if I think that you're really wonderful and I have 5 other friends that I think are great, it's in my best interest to introduce you to all of them. Mm-hmm. Because the stronger the social ties are between you, the greater level of connectivity we'll have, right? Mm-hmm. And the more influence we'll have on one another. Mm-hmm. Now, if I think you're a terrible human being, I want to avoid you at all costs. But like, the interesting thing about this is we all kind of know this to some degree, but we don't live like it's true. And so I said, what would it be like if I actually took this to the next level, right? If I said, okay, if people have such a profound impact on one another, then not only do I want to meet the most influential people across industry, but I want them to connect with each other so that there's a strong, densely packed collection of social ties. And that ultimately is called a community. So I started looking at any research that could help me understand this better. And that also included, like, I'm going to interview an admin that works with a famous executive to understand what their lives are actually like. And their lives are nothing like the image that you would think, right? If you're an executive, your image of them, or even like a celebrity, is that they're like at swanky parties all the time and doing really sexy things. Being on set at a movie is not sexy. It's work. Mm-hmm. You're mostly sitting around waiting for your turn. Things are constantly going wrong. People are tired and cranky. It's work. Then 3% of the time, maybe they get to do something super sexy that gets a lot of attention, like the Grammys, the Emmys, whatever it is, right? The Oscars. The people constantly want things from them. They're constantly getting requests. Everybody expects them to agree to do things, either donate, right? Like, so there's a lot of social pressures. And I figured if I could understand their social pressures, that's where my access point would be, because it would allow me to differentiate myself by not doing what everybody else does. And so after a whole bunch of research, I ended up with this completely absurd idea, which was I was going to get people to come to my home, cook me dinner, wash my dishes, clean my floors, and then thank me for it. And this became known as the influencers dinner. So we invited 12 people at a time.
Well, hold on. Let me stop here. How did you pick these people? And then how did you invite them?
So the simple answer is nowadays I don't pick them. We have a board of people who pick them. Mm-hmm. I try to stay away from it because I like to be surprised to find out who I'm sitting with. In the early days, I didn't have a huge selection because I didn't know people. I'm a child of immigrants. I didn't come from like the quote unquote right family. My parents did well when I was like later in life, but when I was a kid, I mean, they're both artists. So what I ended up doing was inviting people who were pretty awesome, but not like famous or anything like that. And we define somebody, or what I did was I separated people into different levels of influence. So you have like the global influencers, like the Oprahs, Sir Richard Bransons, Bill Gates, Beyonce, right? You have the industry level influencers. These are CEOs of the Fortune 500, right? The CMOs, the people who have industry respect through their thought leadership, right? So you could be a professor, you could be an author, journalist. Your position, you're the editor-in-chief, you're the CFO, whatever, right? Or previous success. So David, if you had built up an amazing company like Activision Blizzard and then sold it, you've got street cred. You don't need to prove anything else to anyone. You could be Tom from MySpace. I think you're awesome, right?
Like Tom is awesome. I follow Tom on Instagram. I'm like, he's really living the life.
He's a good photographer, right?
Yeah, he's great.
I know. I heard that like after all he really wanted to do was travel and photograph stuff. And I think that that's awesome that he actually did that, because it's so tempting to just try to like, you know, go back into the grind.
Or go to Mars or something. But he's going in.
I think the phrase is die on Mars.
He's going on an inward journey instead. And I find that really compelling. So Tom, yeah. I wish they should make a movie about him. Like I would like to see,
The Social Network too.
Yeah. I want to see a David Fincher movie about Tom. I want Nine Inch Nails to do the music. It would be cool. Like, I'm not joking. I would love that. This is why I can't actually be a billionaire, because I would fund that movie and I would make Goonies 2 and starring Josh Brolin. And,
it all begins the day after the snap when they realize that the only ones.
That's right. The Goonies are the only ones who could save us.
The Goonies have to go find a way to get them. And they're the ones that really saved the Marvel universe.
Yeah. If anyone's hearing this, that is a solid pitch. Greenlight it now. I will take no credit.
I hear Gizmo really helped it all come together.
That's good. Now we're getting into Ready Player One territory. We can't get too many pop references. This is, okay, I'm with you on this. I'm following your story. I like that you plan to have these people together, but you have a quirk in here that I thought was really cool, and I don't want you to miss, to move past it, which is the people don't get to know each other. The people who come don't know who each other are.
It's completely anonymous.
They don't
know
like
the hacker group, but like they don't know.
They don't know what the other people do. Why they've been invited? Then they may not even know who they are at all, which is a big part of it. So if I can jump back in your story from there.
So they get people are invited via email. Most of the time, they've had zero contact with us ahead of time. And when we looked at what would compel people, we were able to kind of find a handful of cues, including novelty and belonging and all these other things. And so we tell people that they'll be one of 12, that when they arrive, they're not allowed to talk about what they do or even give their last name. That they'll be cooking dinner together. And that when we sit to eat, we'll be playing a game where we try and guess what everybody does. And that if you want to know who the other guests are, we're not going to tell you, but we will tell you the types of people who come. And those are Nobel laureates, Olympians, editors-in-chief, celebrities, Oscar winners, Grammy winners. I mean, you name it, we've had everybody. We've hosted over 2,000 people at 227 dinners. And so it's developed into quite the community. And then after about half of the dinners, we also host an experience called Inspired Culture. And Inspired Culture is a salon where we have about 60 to 100 people. And then in that group, three people kind of jump out and nobody knows who they're going to be. And they give presentations. So like 10 minutes each with 2 minutes Q&A. But it'll be Bill Nye the Science Guy and Larry Wilmore and, you know, Bjarke Ingels, the famed architect, and one of the former Roots will perform, and one of the, you know, so on and so forth. And it's like a treat. It's super fun. It's very tiring, to be honest.
This is so cool. And you pulled out of this like a formula, which I really dig. I'll just prompt you with just that much so you can fill the rest in. But to prepare people listening, you did this enough for you started to feel like you had hit on something important that can be articulated as a social formula. So what is
that? Yeah. So I want to emphasize this is a formula that nobody would ever bother solving. It's just in the sense that it demonstrates kind of a relationship between things. And that is that our influence, our ability to have an impact on people or an outcome, is really a factor of three things. The first is who we're connected to. Because you really can't influence anybody that you're not connected to. You can try to have some of that like secondary, right, through people you have in common, but it's much harder to do in a predictable way. The second is how much they trust you, because unlike force, influence is kind of an opt-in thing. You're at least the way that we talk about it now. There are things that influence us, like the temperature in the room, that we don't pay attention to. But you've got to be pretty deliberate to turn up the temperature in the room in order to affect people's behavior. And that's like some Disney theme park or casino type of stuff.
Or 1970s social science.
Yes. Here, I'm going to lock you in this room with dressed like a cop and let's see what happens.
That's right. They fill the room with smoke. Everybody's an actor but you. And everybody's calm. That's a real study that I love, where everybody's calm, but the room slowly fills with smoke, and they measure how long people sit there until they go, "Hey, shouldn't we be worried about the smoke?" And the variable was how many people were actors versus
Subjects.
Cohorts. And that's scary because they would wait way past the point where you would die because they're like, well, nobody's freaking out. So I guess I'm the only...
I'm curious if you just hire a bunch of people and tell them that it's fine. So it's all actors.
That's
if just like they sit there and die.
That's
no, it's supposed to be this way.
That's
because
good.
They don't know the others are actors, do they?
I don't know. Well, that makes me want to go back and look but that's a good 1970s diabolical social science study. So
mm-hmm. Yeah. So the second factor is trust, mm-hmm. because if I don't trust you, then it's going to be really hard for you to influence me. Now, I should emphasize, and I go into a little bit of this in the book, but trust is often contextual, meaning that if I need heart surgery, I'm definitely not going to trust you. But if I need, you know, hey, do you know study on X topic? I'll probably come to you and say, hey, any insights? And I'll trust that what you're saying is accurate because that's your specialty. And then the third characteristic is the sense of community that you share. And the reason is twofold. One is you'll notice, let's say, David, you were traveling through Japan, right? And you met another American who lives in the same block that you do. Suddenly you will have an instant rapport with each other. There's no real reason you should, but there's this sense of belonging that you suddenly have, this sense of community. As a byproduct, you have a greater influence. The other reason is what we discussed earlier, which is the closer your social ties are to each other, the easier it is for something to spread across the community. So the stronger the community, the more ability to influence you have. And so the relationship between those three factors, you could try and quantify it numerically if you want, but I just generally expressed it as that it's who we're connected to times how much they trust us and to the exponent of the level of community that you have. Now, there's like, I don't like, it's not something you'd solve, right?
That was good. I mean, I that appeals to me, but I appreciate that you were like, I probably should explain this as a full book instead of just putting out this formula and saying I figured it out. What about the variables? I don't mean to, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to talk over you, but I didn't want to get away from what you're saying here until you mentioned novelty and the IKEA effect and how mm-hmm. these are very important for what plugs into this formula you're talking about.
Oh, for sure. So I think the first thing to realize is that in general, everything that we do for all three of those categories is wrong. And here's what I mean. In American society, you're turned 21 years old, you're trying to get an internship, you go to somebody for some advice and they're like, listen, your relationships really matter. You have to go out there and do this. What's the this? To succeed, go out there and network. And nobody likes networking.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe there's like a handful of people, but like in general, nobody likes it. Francesca Gino at HBS did a study that found that people's implicit association to it is that they feel dirty. But they don't feel that way about making friends.
Mm-hmm.
And so our fundamental context for how we build relationships is off. We see it as a transaction where we are using one another and feel bad about it. Instead of how do people make friends and how do I get how do I get them to want to connect with me in a positive way? And so people generally make friends over shared interests. I don't know, maybe you're a stamp collector or something. I don't know. And then suddenly you meet other stamp collectors and you become friends over that. Activities, that's more like you play soccer. You're a competitive Quidditch player. And the third is you have a shared history or culture, right? So you go to your religious institution of whatever every once a week and you participate in the traditions. And as a byproduct, you bond with the people around you. Mm-hmm. And you become friends with them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how people tend to connect. But if we really want to get people's attention, that's not going to be enough, right? So like, I could invite Sir Richard Branson to play soccer. He might be able to love soccer, right? Like, absolutely love it. But he gets invited to so much, it won't show up on his radar. In general, the more influential a person is, you can say successful, depending on your definition of success, the more demands they have on them, the more isolated they actually tend to feel because it's lonely at the top. So somebody at Oprah's level has layer upon layer of security, including private security, including an executive assistant who probably has an assistant, and, you know, like manager, agent, staff, heads of companies. Everything is designed to keep people away. So the more influential somebody is, if you're a company leader, you're maybe not being stopped on the street, but everybody wants your time and your money, your expertise, then we need to kind of put a few critical elements in place. Now, among them, I'd say, are generosity, right? You want to give without the expectation of anything in return, because these people are constantly being asked for stuff. But one of the most important things is novelty. And that is, there's a section of the brain called the SNVTA. It's the major novelty center of the brain. And when we experience, see, or are exposed to something novel, it responds relative and entices us to explore and understand it. Like, you literally want to go out and see the thing, do that thing. And the problem is that we keep doing the same stupid, junky things over and over again. So people have a launch party with a photo booth and flowers, check, and food, check. And then people awkwardly stand around loud music, wondering why they're there. There's nothing novel about that. And so it's not anything that's going to attract us. The other things that are important are, the most influential people in our culture, everybody thinks that they spend their time hanging out with other influential people. And that is just not true. They spend most of their times with their admins and their teams. So if you can curate an environment with other influential people, they'll go far out of their way to be there. Now, I want to emphasize this. When I started, I did not know influential people. I knew a handful of people who were across industry who did very well. But because of the consistency that I continuously ran the dinners at, over time, I was able to find email addresses for people and bump into people at events and say, hey, I'm running this, and get recommendations of other people. And over time, it became something more impressive. But I didn't know like the people I know now. That took me a decade to get there. Well, it took me much less to get there, but, you know, now it's just a lot more people.
Yeah. And now you are one of these people who probably get invited to lots of things.
You would think. I think people generally assume that I'm at those things already and they shouldn't bother me.
Maybe I'm just terrible company. This thing about novelty fascinates me mainly because our sense-making brain stuff directs all of this, our sensory modalities, to grab up as much information as possible from the salient thing that doesn't seem like we've seen it before or experienced it before. And then we can assimilate it, hopefully, and if we can't, then we get to accommodate and expand the range of our entire hierarchy of abstractions and become a more realized entity of some kind, right? So this appeals to me in a great deal. Thinking about it in terms of the world you're talking about, I just had this strange thought fly through my head, which is the, for we who have not been offered a hand onto the stage in some way or another, whatever that means in your particular line of obsession with the world, all of it's novel, right? It's like at first, like just the idea that to even be massive novelty already, like, so I want to do that. I want to be invited to one of these photo booth things. I want to go to an awards ceremony. I want to go on a movie set. I wanted this novelty. It's, you don't become aware of how quickly you become acclimated to that and how boring it is until you've done it once.
The hedonic treadmill, right?
Yeah.
So I agree completely. You know, I used to spend a lot of my life traveling. I was on the road, I don't even know how many days, but there was like 1 year I went to 19 countries. And what I can tell you is I love traveling and I miss it very much right now. But when you've been to 50 countries, the 51st country is kind of like a mesh of the previous countries, right? And at a certain point, the joke is David, do you know it's better than having platinum status with your airline?
No, I do not. Please tell me.
Getting to see your friends and family. Right? So yeah. It's kind of at a certain point, right? It's got the standard curve. Like, it's really great and wonderful up until a point. And then what you're missing out on is more valuable than what you're gaining. Mm-hmm. And so it's, you know, when you look at the greatest predictors of human longevity, it isn't number of countries visited. It isn't number of Emmys or Grammys or whatever it is that you've attended. The greatest predictors, number two is, this is after genetics, which we can't control. Number two is close social ties. And number one is social integration, right? You're part of the community. And so at a certain point, you got to kind of just say, okay, I get it. This is novel. This is exciting. We need some novelty in our life. And that's great. But once you've experienced it all, then what? Right? Like, there's probably a certain rate at which we want to be consuming novelty.
Yeah. Well, this is the genius of what you've pulled off. You combine novelty with social integration and made this thing out of these two. It's a very yin yang thing you did here. You had these, this is a matter antimatter social reaction. You took novelty, which we can.
Scotty would be proud of
you took this thing that we can acclimate to quite easily, and a person who is a major influencer at the level of an Oprah or a Nobel laureate is very acclimated to it. So then you introduced, what about the novelty of community? What about the novelty of hanging out with human beings and being gross and messy and eating burritos and
oh, interesting. I always associate it as the novelty of, here are a bunch of constraints. You can't talk about work or give the law.
Oh yeah, sure. I mean, but like the appeal of it is so, I mean, the downstream effect of the whole thing is this, like, you created, I mean, you're turning lead into gold. You're transmutating this thing that can feel gross into something that feels the most opposite of it you can feel as a social primate. And I think that's,
you know, what's incredible. I think is super funny about this is that, it's really doing the things that we would naturally be doing if we were in a hunter-gatherer society.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's the joint investment of effort into activities that were traditionally associated with our survival or with play. But there's nothing threatening about it. It is perfectly safe. And, you know, when we haven't gotten to dive into this yet, but the second factor that I keep talking about is trust. And, you know, in American society, the way we try to build trust is often to buy people off, right? I take you out for an expensive business dinner, or what's the other thing people do? Oh, I'll invite you to a party that has a swag bag. Now, all of us are really excited to, like, look in that swag bag, and we'll, like, pull out the one thing that we kind of want, like a Kind bar, put in our pocket, and then literally toss the rest, creating more trash in the world. Mm-hmm. And we know that kind of stuff doesn't really work. Right? Now, what's odd is the exact opposite does, and it's called the IKEA effect. And it states that people care more about their IKEA furniture because they had to suffer through assembling it. Right? Like, anything we invest effort into, we tend to care about more. And that means that we're doing a whole lot of stuff wrong. First of all, I don't know if you were like me growing up, but I never liked asking people for help because I felt like, I'm going to figure it out. I'm going to do it on my own. But that's dumb.
It's like, so dumb. So
it literally, I'm causing people to care less about me. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right? If somebody's offering to invest effort to support me, I should say yes almost every single time. Because then they'll care more about me and I'm going to be better off as a byproduct. It also means that reciprocity is necessary at times. You don't want to be like some selfish taker, right?
No, I hear you. The way I started this podcast, the first thing I did was I emailed Mark Maron because he had the number one podcast.
And I said, I mean, I don't know Mark Maron. He doesn't know me. I said, I'm thinking about starting a podcast. I don't know what to buy, but I feel like you do. And he emailed me back with a bulleted list of Amazon links that were clickable and said it was two lines.
Ooh, he really enjoyed the affiliate money you made him, all $3.25.
He was like,
"Way to go, Mark Maron! You genius."
He said, here's what I think you should get. Here's what I use. Good luck." That was it, right? But I can't believe he took time out of his day to do that. It blew my mind. I have thankfully, I think, mostly extracted the thing that came out of both of our childhoods, even though I feel that first. I feel it first in some sort of chain of like cognition where I'm like, I can do this by myself. And like, don't you remember that you can talk to people? And some people, almost everyone I've emailed has at least emailed me back to say no thank you, which for some reason is validating. So it's huge. The IKEA effect thing is enormous. And it's odd, so much of what you're talking about is counterintuitive because it seems like it plugs in so well, like you were saying, into our innate propensities, right? If I remember correctly, another thing about that was that's why you have to have an egg to make cake, right? Because it feels better to make a cake if you have to put a little effort into it.
Okay. So what you're talking about was that famous, I think it was like a 1950s product release concept where dessert companies tried to sell pre-made cakes at supermarkets, but realized that at the time housewives weren't liking the idea because they didn't feel like they could say it was theirs.
Right.
When they served it. And so what they did was they created a pre-packaged formula where really all they needed to do was add oil, water, and eggs. And even though that is an inconsequential amount of effort, it allowed them to claim ownership.
Let me look, I've got notes here from your book, and I wanted to, you had talked a good bit about trust, and we've talked about the IKEA effect. There's so much in here, I don't even know where to start. You've got more than 20 chapters of material.
Just so that people know, it's not that I was like overly verbose, just a bunch of the chapters are really small, short. It's not like this isn't like a thinking fast, thinking slow book.
I mean, you talk about
paperweight.
Sororities, the halo effect, vulnerability loops, moral molecule, the hummingbird problem, what trust is made of, the benefit of belonging, all these things. I will get to one of those if possible, but I know when people listen to shows like this, and I've been told this by about a dozen editors with my own material, because I used to have this propensity to just go, and there's the science, enjoy your life. And they're like, oh, you weren't going to give us any advice? It's all descriptive and not prescriptive. Mm-hmm. So in your book, you talk about some things where this could be applied. You know, maybe you want to try this dinner idea that you've come up with, which is fine. But sort of bounce through a couple of these. How would you apply this to, let's say, a business for one, a cause-based community two, and then three, your own life, your own social communities?
Great. So let's tackle the social communities first, because I think that kind of is the most fun and playful, right? So if you want to build a social circle that you really love, and what we've realized is that human beings connect over interest, activities, or culture, then the first thing you kind of want to ask yourself is, do you want to start something yourself, or do you want to join something that already exists? Because some people just aren't going to start stuff. Not everybody needs the entrepreneurial bug, right? Not everybody needs to host a bunch of people in their house. And if you're not going to start stuff, go on to meetup.com and like find communities, and then kind of use the knowledge of like the IKEA effect and all that to catalyze the conversations happening more naturally, right? If you are going to start something, here's the most important first step. Have it be something you actually enjoy. Because if I hated dinner time, after running it 20 times, I'd start getting really annoyed. By 50, I would have hated my life. And now at 227, I would rather be dead, right? But it's something that I enjoy. So if you enjoy knitting, if you enjoy, running, if you enjoy board games, all those are an option. Pick something that you love or that you enjoy, and then turn it into something that people could get that people could invest effort into, so that you get that IKEA effect. You like painting? Great. There's a woman in California who did this super cool painting project. She drew one large image across 5x5 canvases, so 25 canvases in total, invited people to come, gave each of them a canvas to paint essentially by number in any way they wanted. And so it could be any color scheme. And then she would reassemble it into a large picture. And that's really nice, because then you're standing next to somebody painting. You can be quiet when you want. You can participate in the conversation when you want. And it feels natural. You're not feeling like you're forced into an interview setting, which is miserable. Then what I would do is I'd keep seeing how to make it more novel, how to curate better over time, but you just keep running it. Maybe you do it every week, every month, whatever it is. Consistency is absolutely essential, because it's near impossible to build a sense of community if you do it once and then never again. Now, if you're with a company and you're doing this for sales reasons, I think the question is, do you want a diverse group like what I have with the influencers, or do you want a homogenous group? Right? So there's nothing wrong with having an industry group. But the key is to, once again, do something that you enjoy, sure, but that is consistent with the company values. So I went to an event at Miami Art Basel where a liquor brand had an art exhibit and a performance. The liquor brand is not based in New York, but they had Alicia Keys perform New York. And I had no idea why any of it was going on, because it's not a brand that particularly cares about the creative world, right? Certain brands have invested lots of money into creative world, right? Like Life Water is known for partnering with artists. This brand wasn't. So it made no sense. Essentially, it was just a really expensive experience, and they got to check off the box that their boss got to hang out with Alicia Keys for a few minutes, and so they felt justified it. In the business world, we tend to make up for bad ideas by spending more money. That one, frankly, was a bad idea, unless there was something going on that I didn't know. So the question is, what would have made it a good idea? Well, you want to begin with your company values, right? If you're a nonprofit, it doesn't make sense to have a that's fighting hunger. It doesn't make sense to be spending $1,000 a plate on food. It kind of just continues to show the inequities. So we don't have enough time to go deep into this, but I would begin with looking at what the organization's core values are and how do you express that with the activity. In some cases, we've done these super fun 5-person game shows where the questions actually end up sharing ideas about the issues that the organizations are trying to tackle. So that way we have a natural starting point for a conversation after the game. And by people playing together, then they bond, they feel that IKEA effect. Rather than lecturing somebody and bringing in a speaker to talk at them, it's now fully interactive. So it's novel and different than most experiences, let's say, on Zoom. So doing things like this changes the game, right? It makes it novel, and depending on who you invite, it's well curated, and it's then consistent with the company's values. And you know, you can really start forming something and then iterate it over time.
If your mission or your goal, your intention is to change the world itself, and you want to leverage the things that you've learned to create to communities that could then affect larger communities, that can affect even larger communities, is there anything you would advise in that domain?
Wow. That's a really big question.
Yeah. I'm literally asking you,
how do you solve the world's problems?
Yeah. How do you change the world, John? How do you change the world?
I think when it comes to social communities or social cause-based activities, what we really forget about is that, especially in the early points, it's about the relationship to the issue and the people who run the org. And what we like to do is say, okay, we raised a whole bunch of money. But that's a terrible business model if every year you have to raise money from scratch. So the question is, how do we get people to put in some effort? and then increase the effort over time so that they continue to care more and more about the organization. Because if I can get you to give $5, great, that's a good start. Can I then get you to give $10 the next month? That's a better start. Can I get you then to, I don't know, wear the emblem of the organization, to host a salon in honor of the cause and invite your friends and give you an activity to run for them? And so I think it's about, if you look, that was the success of the abolitionist movement in the history of our country, is that there were people who were incredibly dedicated, who developed this kind of format for speakers coming and conversations taking place. And then as people were empowered by the community, they were invited to open their own and spread the message. And it really spread person to person. It's nice to have a flash on social media and people like it, but that's not the same as people being dedicated to a movement.
And this is also something that I'm obsessed with, the idea of cascades and how social movements kick off, and the power of small groups and all those things that, and also just the idea that you can strike at a complex system in the exact same way 1,000 times, and 999 times no cascade takes place. And then on the 1,000th time, it spreads the entire network. And that's all, you know, out of network science. And there's a couple of good books about how all that works. But I look at, it was what came to mind immediately when I was looking through your material, because I was, one of the things that most of those books or those research papers don't say, actually, they'll get to that point in the paper and they say, so how would you make this happen? And most of the time I say, you can't, because the network is too vastly complex for you to know when there's a percolating local cluster and it's undulating, and there you don't know how to make diffusion. You can't brute force diffusion for the most part. And so that's when survivorship bias comes in, where you're like, we have instances of times when that's happened, but you could probably do the same thing 1,000 times. And you start Starbucks on a Tuesday instead of on a Thursday, and you don't get, you get one Starbucks, right? So, but looking at your material, I was like, this guy might have figured something out in this regard. Like this might be like, I don't know if there are probably a billion wrong ways, but if there's something along the path of the right way, I feel like you're on it. This is how everything has ever happened that has cascaded beyond a small group of people who are obsessed with something. There's a documentary right now, and I think it's on Netflix, of competitive dog dying, where you dye a dog to look like a work of art. And I have seen Pennywise the Clown, except it's in the fur of a poodle. And that person won a competition. But what I found more compelling than anything in that documentary was there's a million people. There's more than a million people that do this every day, and I had no idea they existed. And they have a vast, complex community that meets and organizes and does stuff. And I feel like changing the world requires that substrate, that foundation, and the things that allow for competitive dog inking also allow for just about anything, right? And you, I feel like, have discovered, and it's probably a co-discovery, but you've written a book about it, and that changes things, about how to brute force start up a social movement of some kind. And it's all about the network more than it is trying to find a tipping point, or more than it's trying to find a very particular connected maven of some kind. It's about the network itself. That's what causes things to happen. That's what's influencing you right now. That's how you and I even met and are doing this thing, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, I feel like you have a great and powerful gift, and this book is a way for it to go through. I will do my part and promote it, but I really appreciate that you committed it to something that people can spend time with and then pick apart and then apply to whatever it is they feel needs this, you know, application. I'm just trying to thank you in some long-winded way.
I'm really appreciative. I'm also really appreciative that you've introduced me to this world of dog dying, because now I'm going to be stuck on YouTube rather than promoting my book. So it was nice knowing you all. I'm going to go down the deepest recesses of YouTube, and inevitably this dog dying documentary will somehow end up with a flat earth video. And
the name of it is Well Groomed, and it is it won at South by Southwest. It is about the weird, wondrous world of competitive dog grooming, which sounds like something that it ain't. It is a much more complex world than you might suspect. And please invite someone from that to one of your dinners.
The biggest dog influencer I can find.
I could talk to you about this forever. I apologize that we don't have more time to dive into it. But the good news is you have a book, which means that anyone who found anyone who heard anything here they found interesting and they want to know more about it, there's a lot of chapters and a lot of stuff to get into. So start with John's TED Talk and then move on to his book. And I think you will find that.
Start with 12 copies of my book, and then I don't really care.
Start by buying a case of the book, and then have a dinner party where you distribute the book, and then we're in business.
And then repeat.
And do that as many times as you can. Oh, also, you have a podcast. Let's mention that too.
No.
I used to have a podcast. Never mind. But there's a podcast floating around, but that's in the past, and we don't talk about it anymore. So, John, is there anything else to say before I let you go? I feel like I ranted.
Yes, all of you who are out there, besides obviously buying my book, reach out to your friends, especially the ones who are like introverted and shy, and invite them to do just about anything, because we are in the midst of a loneliness epidemic, and we need each other a lot. And the biggest gift you can give somebody is company right now.
You can find John Levy on Twitter at John Levy TLB. That's JonLevyTLB. And on Instagram at the same. His website is yourinvited.info. And his personal website is jonlevy.com. My new book, How Minds Change, you can find a link to all of the information about that in the show notes right there in your podcast player. It goes to the homepage for How Minds Change, where you can find a roundtable video with a group of persuasion experts featured in the book. You can also read a sample chapter, download a discussion guide, sign up for the newsletter, read reviews, and if you scroll to the bottom, you'll find links to all the many, many podcasts and YouTube channels I've been appearing on telling everybody about it. Oh, and there's a link to the contest to win a copy of the book as well in your show notes. Oh, and there's also a link to the newsletter I was going to post there for the first time this week, but I got the COVID. So I'm just getting over that right now. I'll be posting there soon. That is it for this episode of the You're Not So Smart podcast. For all the past episodes, go to Stitcher, SoundCloud, iTunes, Omni, Spotify, Audible, Amazon, or yournotsosmart.com. Follow me on Twitter at David McRaney. Follow the show at Not Smart Blog. Also, we're on Facebook at @YouAreNotSoSmart. And if you'd like to support this operation, help make it better, help pay for transcription and other features, go to patreon.com/YouAreNotSoSmart. Pitching in at any amount gets you the show ad-free. The higher amounts get you posters, t-shirts, signed books, and other stuff. The opening music, that's Clash by Caravan Palace. This music is by Incompetech. If there was an episode that really meant something to you, gave you value, or you just want to tell people about it, that's the best way to support the show. And check back in 2 weeks for a fresh new episode. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. And I was having dinner with one of my friends just a couple days ago. He moved to San Francisco. We hadn't seen each other in a while. And we were having one of those remember your childhood back and forths, all the weird things that our families did and all the things they didn't do and the lessons we learned and when we learned them and how some of them were way deep into adulthood. And we were discussing therapy. Like, when did you start therapy? Did you think it would be the way it turned out it was? And wow, it would have been nice to know about this a lot earlier. And I want you to go to therapy. I want you to see what it's like, what happens there, to get an idea of what therapy really is. And BetterHelp is a great way to do that very thing. For instance, here's something that therapy offers. It can be easy to ignore our social battery, you know, drained, bursting with energy.
And this also could be something that's related to not having enough boundaries or having improper boundaries. Maybe you're less social in the winter. Maybe you act completely differently in a party environment than you do at work. And all of these things are swirling around, and you know there's something to understand in here concerning this social battery concept, what it's like to spread yourself thin. So what is the right amount of socializing for you? And how do you recharge before, during, and after? Maybe you thrive around people. Maybe you need a lot of alone time. What's going on there? Well, therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that makes sense to you, that doesn't drain your social battery. And if you're thinking of starting therapy, I really recommend you give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient and flexible and suited to your schedule. And you just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch that therapist for another therapist anytime for no additional charge. So if you're like me and my friend who were discussing when we started therapy, and you were talking about not only your childhoods, but when you discovered how to be properly social in a way that did not drain you, you can do this with BetterHelp. You can find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. If you haven't done it yet, you can do it now by visiting betterhelp.com/YANSS. If you do that today, you'll get 10% off your first month. How do you do that? By using that URL. Once again, that's betterhelp.com/YANSS.